Well, the birthday present I really would have liked to have offered is certainly a real understanding of QCD based on the one-over-n expansion. And that's not only because of the importance of the problem, but because, as I explained yesterday, it's kind of bothersome to have this unfinished homework after 25 minutes. Now, a second best birthday present still would have been to give some kind of new insight about confinement. That wouldn't have been dramatic as it would have been a decade ago, because there were many new insights on confinement in the 90s, mostly involving supersymmetry and string theory in different ways. But I'm afraid I don't even quite have that. The closest I can come to is to explain a recent new insight about confinement, which I have nothing to do with. It's formulated by Bobby Acharya. But I'm actually going to spend most of the time placing it in context. And unfortunately, both because of the fact that I only have half an hour and because of the fact that we didn't quite get far enough, as I'll explain later, I'm not going to even do very much of putting this in context. I'll set the stage, but maybe it'll have to be the 61st birthday party to really put that in context. Now, in studying supersymmetric compactifications of string theory, something which in the non-perturbative epoch of the 90s we learned was very important is to study the behavior at a singularity. So, for example, there are the Orbifold singularities of K3 surfaces, and there are the Kahnfold and other singularities of Clavier-3 folds, and there are other more exotic singularities. There are several reasons it's important to understand what happens at a singularity. One is that that's where field theory breaks down and non-perturbative things happen, but still it's localized in space, so you can often learn what happens. And the answers are often interesting, and in addition are often important for understanding non-perturbative dualities. And when one investigates the behavior at singularities, a lot of interesting questions come up, which may be familiar from the examples I just mentioned. Can you hear me in the back, by the way?
Yes,
okay. So typical questions are, well, first, as I said, what happens in the quantum theory when the classical theory breaks down because of a singularity? Does extra gauge symmetry appear? Are there new massless particles? Does the physics remain infrared free, as we'd expect in our unrenormalizable effective actions derived from string theory at a generic place? Or do we instead get a non-trivial infrared fixed point? By going through a singularity, can you come out on the other side with a different manifold? And if there are transitions to different spacetimes, do they occur smoothly, where a low-energy physicist would not see anything funny happening? Or is there a phase transition where you jump to a different branch of moduli space? So these are typical questions that are asked about singularities, about where you want to know what happens in string theory when the classical supergravity becomes singular and therefore useless. Well, usually the answer to such a question depends on physics that occurs near the singularity. We might have a big manifold where ordinary low-energy field theory is valid throughout most of the space, but somewhere there is a singularity, so supergravity is breaking down in a localized fashion, and that's where strong coupling effects might happen. And one, as I said already, one of the reasons that we can often get answers is that this is much more controlled than if supergravity was breaking down everywhere. It breaks down in a localized fashion near a singularity, and you can often actually learn what happens. So the important singularities, or at least the most basic ones, are usually conical. Conical means that the metric is of the form dr squared plus r squared times something, where r is a radial parameter. I hope one of these two terms works. And d omega squared is a metric on some smooth manifold. If the manifold were simply a sphere, this would just be flat space, Rn. But we get a singularity if we have a cone on something other than a sphere. For example, the ADE singularities are cones on the quotient of a sphere by a finite group. And the Kahnfold is a cone on a situation that Igor Klebanov talked about yesterday. It's a cone on this 5-manifold there. And there are lots of these conical singularities that have been studied in the Clavier case. Now, I said the conical singularities are the basic ones, but the other ones that are usually studied are intersections of conical singularities, roughly speaking. And that often also gives interesting results. But the conical singularities are the most basic ones. Now, I'm going to be reporting on recent work with Michael Attia, where we've studied issues similar to what I just mentioned, not for Calabi-Yau compactification, but for M-theory compactification on a manifold of G2 holonomy that I'll call X. So you don't have to know much about G2, really. Nothing, in fact, for this lecture. In the classification of what kind of Riemannian metrics are possible, there are generic ones and there are various exceptional ones. And one of the most exceptional ones is something called G2 holonomy, which is possible for a 7-manifold. And its importance in physics is that if you compactify M-theory on a manifold of G2 holonomy, you get a 4-dimensional theory with N equals 1 supersymmetry. It's even, at least remotely conceivable, that you can make interesting models of particle physics from singular manifolds of G2 holonomy. It's easy to see that smooth ones won't do. But the kind of thing I'll be talking about is leagues away from that. We'll just ask, what happens in M-theory when a manifold of G2 holonomy develops an isolated conical singularity? Now, there's previous work on this by Acharya and by Attia, Modisena, and Bafa, who had lots of interesting results, including a proposal for a new explanation of the mass gap, and in essentially in the second paper, and in Acharya's work, an explanation of confinement in the n equals 1 extension of 4-dimensional gauge theory. So that's what I was alluding to at the very beginning when I said that there is here a kind of new insight about confinement. And I'll briefly get back to it at the end. So, but there are a lot of questions if you look at these papers closely, and Attia and I wanted to make a more systematic framework for understanding these results as well as others. So, now one thing that makes this relatively simple is that there aren't that many examples known. In fact, as far as I know, there only are 3 known simply connected examples of an isolated conical singularity of a manifold of V2 holonomy. And we've investigated all of them, and I'll kind of give you an overview of the results. And then, although I won't have time to do it properly,
I'll say a word or two about the extension to the non-simply connected case that leads back to the results about gauge theory that I just mentioned. So on this table, I've shown the following. So in the first column, well, here I've given the smooth manifold that you get when you have a conical singularity. Usually in these situations, you can deform it to a smooth manifold. You could go far away from the singular case. But the interest here is what happens when you're very close to the singular case. So our singular manifolds will be cone on something. I've called the something y. And in the 3 known examples, at least the 3 examples I've heard of, y is, well, it's a cone on CT3, SU3 mod U1 squared, or S3 times S3. The smooth manifold you can get by deforming the cone is one of these 3. They're actually fiber bundles rather than products, but I want it to be simple there. I don't want to get into details. When the smooth manifold is developing a singularity, it does that by a cycle shrinking, analogous to Strominger's collapsing 3 cycle in the conifold case. So the cycle which is collapsing is an S4, a CP2, or an S3. In each case, there's one complex modulus that describes the problem. But one basic thing you have to ask is whether that modulus is a field that can fluctuate with a finite energy, or whether it's more like a coupling constant that somebody who sets up this problem specifies by giving you boundary conditions at infinity. And then you can study the physics as you vary the coupling. So that's determined by whether the mode, the modulus mode, is an L2 or not. So, by the way, I should say, I'm not going to use any detailed classical facts in this lecture, which is why I forgot to write this on the transparencies. But there have been a lot of really nice papers, a whole series of really nice papers written lately by Gibbons, Cvetic, Pope, and their collaborators, on which Cvetic reported at Strings 2001 in Mumbai. And, well, they've developed a lot more detailed properties that aren't going to enter at the level of detail of this talk, but certainly this question of whether the modulus is dynamical, in other words, whether the mode is an L2, is a beginning example of the kind of thing they did. Now, a more subtle question is how many manifolds there are. And by that I mean the following. The singular case is a cone on Y, and then I said that Y can be deformed to a smooth manifold, which was X. But there might be topologically different ways of doing this. The most classic case is the so-called flop of a Calabi-Yau threefold. Well, there's both the flop and the conifold transition. For the cone on what Klebanov talked about, the cone on T11 in type 2A, there are three ways to deform it to a smooth manifold. I don't really want to. So the integer I'm listing here would be 3 in that example. So in this first example, there's really only one way, at least, that's known to deform it to a smooth manifold of G2 holonomy. But in the other two cases, there are three ways to do it. They're all topologically the same, but they're not the diffeomorphisms that map one to another is non-trivial at infinity. So if you've nailed down how you're defining your observables at infinity, then from that point of view, there are three different ways to fill in the interior in these two examples, and only one here. So if you embed it in a compact manifold of G2 holonomy, these three would be topologically different. So our question of whether you can make transitions from one manifold to another will arise in these two cases, because in each of those cases there are three candidate manifolds among which you might want to make transitions, but it won't arise in the first case. Now, it turns out that the first two examples are much easier to understand than the third. So the first two examples are the ones which have a dynamical modulus, which means that in four-dimensional physics, you have a massless chiral superfield whose effective action you'd like to describe. So I'll consider first the first example, the one which is asymptotic to a cone on CP3. It's got one chiral superfield because the volume of the S4, if you deform it to a smooth manifold of this topology, the S4 has a volume which is the absolute value of a chiral superfield. And actually, this chiral superfield is the volume of the S4 times a certain phase, which is a period of the M-theory 3 form field. And there's a U1 symmetry of the problem that rotates phi, adding a constant to that phase. And this U1 symmetry is easy to see from supergravity. It arises from the gauge invariance of the 3 form field, which I'll call C, in M-theory. Now, as always in gauge theory, in a gauge theory you have infinitely many local gauge transformations you can make, but the ones that act non-trivially on the physical degrees of freedom are, roughly speaking, the global gauge transformations, which are the gauge transformations that leave fixed the data at infinity. The gauge transformations that vanish at infinity can be thrown away by Gauss's law. And the gauge transformations that don't vanish at infinity and don't leave fixed the data there are spontaneously broken. So the important gauge transformations to look at are the ones that leave fixed the fields at infinity. In the case of the M-theory 3 form, the basic gauge transformation law is delta C equals d lambda, where lambda is a 2 form. And so a symmetry generator should obey d lambda equals 0 at infinity. So in M-theory, in our example, M-theory compactified to 4 dimensions on X, where X is that example I'm talking about, asymptotic to a cone on CP3. The global symmetry group that comes from the 3 form, C, is the second cohomology of Y with U1 coefficients. That's just found by looking for the lambdas with d lambda equals 0. And that group is U1 in this case. Well, for any Y, it would be H2 of Y with U1 coefficients, but it's U1 if Y is CP3. Those are the gauge symmetries that come from this 3 form. Unbroken ones would mean that d lambda was 0 everywhere, so that the gauge transformation not only leaves fixed the stuff at infinity, but also leaves fixed the whole vacuum. In this case, the group of global gauge transformations, which will be observed as a global symmetry group of a 4-dimensional observer. So the symmetry group of this origin is U1. But it's spontaneously broken because lambda obeys at infinity, d lambda equals 0. But you can't extend it over the interior to obey that condition, because H2 of x with U1 coefficients is 0. So this theory has a U1 global symmetry. That is spontaneously broken to nothing, and it's acting on a chiral superfield. It acts on the chiral superfield just by rotating it. Because, as I already said, the chiral superfield is the volume of the four-cycle times a phase, and that phase, if you follow through my definitions, is rotated by the U1. Now, with this information, we can guess what the physics is. Classically, when the volume goes to 0, x becomes exactly conical. We want to know what happens when the space-time gets that singularity. And the answer, I'll claim, is as close to nothing as possible. The formula suggests that all that happens when the volume is 0 is that phi is 0 and the U1 symmetry is restored. No additional massless particles are needed to make sense out of the physics of this example. Now, a lot of times in this duality business, you set up the facts like we did, and you find the simplest thing that obeys them, and then you tend to believe it. There's no evidence here for any additional massless particles, and it looks like, to the naked eye, like all that would happen is that phi is 0 and the symmetry is restored. There's an amusing way in this example to more or less prove that this is the right answer by comparing to type 2a. So CP3 has a big symmetry group, SU4. You can actually find a U1 symmetry generator of CP3 such that the quotient is a 5 sphere. It's a really weird statement because CP3 is not a circle bundle over S5. So this U1 can't act freely on CP3. It has fixed points. And fixed points in general you wouldn't understand. But there's one important case where you do understand them, the codimension 4 fixed points. The idea of this, as in Stromberg's work, actually, dividing by U1 and interpret the quotient space as a type 2a spacetime. And fixed points of just the right type correspond to six brains in type 2a. So we can actually pick the U1 here so that the quotient is a 5 sphere. And the singularities from the fixed points of the group action just have to do with six brains. So if CP3 mod U1 is S5, then if we took a cone on CP3, we'd get a cone on S5, which is R6. So we just land in flat space, no manifold of G2 holonomy. But we have some brains, and it turns out that the brains are just two copies of R3 that intersect at a point. Well, for two intersecting brains under certain conditions, which are obeyed here because of the supersymmetry, you get a massless chiral superfield. I called them six brains, but they fill out R4, which is Minkowski space, times an R3, which is inside R6. They're just flat six brains. We've landed in flat space, even though we were studying a problem with G2 holonomy. And you see, a brain has a U1 gauge symmetry, but because these brains are non-compact, the gauge symmetry is observed as a global symmetry in the effective four-dimensional physics. And this chiral multiplet carries that gauge symmetry. And since the brains are flat, we can just look at chapter 8 of Joe Polchinski's textbook, volume 1, and learn how to calculate everything. Actually, it's supersymmetric, so we have to go to volume 2, but anyway. The physics is what I said. It's completely trivial. There's one interesting thing. Okay. There's a U1 gauge symmetry, and we, since I started at the cone, we landed here. But if you read this work of Joyce and elaborated from a physical viewpoint by Kachura and McGreevy, you learn that this massless chiral superfield giving it a VEV corresponds to deforming the two R3s to a smooth special Lagrangian manifold that you can actually find in closed form. And this, if we had started not with the cone on CP3, but with the smooth manifold of G2 holonomy on Tuck the quotient, the fixed point set turns out to be this thing. For brevity, I'm ignoring various details, like the fact that the dilaton grows at infinity, which we hope are irrelevant near the singularity.
in the spirit of the way that Ukri and Bhava studied the relation, the gauge symmetry of the AN singularity. Now, our second example is very similar, except that the answer is more interesting. The second example was the cone on this thing. And the smooth manifold you can make is this one. But there's a new element, which is triality. The manifold Y at infinity has the obvious SU3 symmetry, but it's got a less obvious triality symmetry group, sigma 3, which, if you want, permutes the three eigenvalues of an SU3 matrix acting on the right. And although the space at infinity has triality symmetry, the space in the interior breaks triality down to a subgroup of permutations of two elements. So there really are three possible x's, x1, x2, and x3. They differ as long as we are literally looking at this non-compact example. They differ by a diffeomorphism, but one that messes, that moves things around drastically at infinity. So they effectively, near the singularity, they look like three different monopoles. Now, one of our questions is, are transitions between these three classical manifolds possible? And the answer is yes, but you have to pass through a phase transition. Well, it can be analyzed quite similarly to the last example. On each of the three manifolds, there's a massless chiral superfield that was the same as I said before. Phi I is the volume of the four-sphere times a phase. Now, the symmetry group, which we analyze at infinity the same way as before, is now not U1, but U1 times U1. And on each of the three manifolds, the unbroken symmetry is U1. So in this problem, U1 times U1 is broken down to U1. But there are three different manifolds, and they break U1 times U1 down to three different U1s. So here I've drawn what's meant to be the root lattice of U1 times U1. But you could think of it as the root lattice of SU3, because it will be more familiar with that name. And the triality symmetry acts by a 2 pi over 3 rotation, as well as some reflections. And the three manifolds, X1, X2, and X3, leave unbroken three different U1 subgroups that correspond to those three directions. Now, let's just try to guess some low-energy physics that does this. We're supposed to have a theory with U1 times U1 symmetry. It has three different branches, on each of which there's a chiral superfield, phi I. And on each branch, there's a different unbroken U1. We can do this if we take the three chiral superfields in this superpotential. Then when we look for critical points of the superpotential, we can give one, any one of the phis can get a VEV, the other two get masses. So there are three branches. On each branch, there's one unbroken U1, a different U1 on each branch. And the three branches meet at a kind of critical point where all the phis are massless. So it's hard to draw it properly because there are three complex branches. But the answer here, if this ansatz for the physics is correct, is that you can make transitions from one branch to another, but you have to pass through a phase transition. Now, again, we can prove this, more or less, by comparing to type 2a. Well, it's rather surprising, but again, there's a U1 symmetry such that Y over U1 is S5, with just the right kind of fixed points to be three brains, or six brains if we include the R4. So the cone on Y divided by U1 is R6. We land in flat space again. And now instead of two R3s, our brains make up three R3s. And now for each pair of R3s, they intersect at the right angle so that there's a massless chiral superfield for each one. So we have three massless chiral superfields. And if we look at the appropriate disk world sheet, we calculate the superpotential phi1, phi2, phi3. So we can explicitly calculate that this is the answer and that there are three branches where one of the phis gets an expectation value. And on the ith branch, two of the three R3s are deformed to a smooth special Lagrangian manifold, and nothing happens to the other one. Okay, well, I'm probably zooming too quickly, but because I wanted to squish in all three examples. But those two examples are the ones which have massless chiral superfields,
because the fluctuation mode is in L2. And they also turn out to have the property that, well, first of all, the low energy physics is not too hard to guess from the symmetries and can be more or less proved by comparing to type 2A. We now come to the last example, which is the most interesting and challenging to understand, and it's because of that challenge that I can't really end up by properly putting in context Acharya's work on confinement. Anyway, okay, now we're looking at the cone on S3 times S3. And it's obvious that S3 times S3 has a symmetry of exchange of the two S3s, but it's less obvious that it can have triality symmetry. How can the group of permutations of three elements act on two S3s? Well, think of one way to do it is to take three group elements, A, B, and C, in SU2. His product is one. It obviously is invariant under cyclic permutations of A, B, and C. And if you work harder, you can also get the odd permutations. But you can solve for one of them, so there really only are two SU2s. So therefore, the group of permutations of three objects can act on the product of two S3s. Not only it can, but when you make a metric of G2 holonomy that's asymptotic to a cone on S3 times S3, the metric you get is invariant under triality. Another way to say it is that you take three group elements, but you take an equivalence relation of dividing by the right action of H, another group element, on G1, G2, and G3. So you can gauge away one of them, so the quotient is the product of the other two SU2s. But on the other hand, it's obvious that the permutation of three elements acts on this. So at infinity, we've got this triality symmetry. And you can deform the cone on Y to a smooth manifold of G2 holonomy in three different ways, breaking the triality symmetry down to a reflection symmetry of two objects. To do that, to make the ith element manifold, you take our three elements of SU2, but you let one of them live in R4. Think of SU2 as the group of unit quaternions, and let one of them be a non-unit quaternion. Impose the same equivalence relation. Well, then we've made the topology of the ith manifold. And since we had to pick one of them that wasn't a unit quaternion, we break the permutations of three objects down to the permutations of two. So now we are in the same setup superficially as in the other case. We've got three different manifolds of G2 holonomy that all meet at a common classical singularity. And now we'd like to ask whether in M theory you can make transitions between them. So in this case you can, but without passing through any phase transition. So this is actually more, the other example was a little bit perhaps like the conifold transition in type 2A, where you can go from one topology to the other, but you jump from one branch to another. This one is more like the flop of type 2A, where you can go completely smoothly from one to another. I should say this was conjectured by Atiyah, Vafa, and Maldacena. And Atiyah and I have been doing some work to make more precise arguments about it, which I won't really have time to explain. So I'll just tell you what the claim is about what happens. First, as I mentioned when I had that table at the beginning, which was an overview, this example doesn't have a dynamical chiral superfield. It's got a coupling constant. Because the volume of the S3 is not dynamical, its fluctuations are described by a mode that isn't in L2. So it's more like a theory with a one complex parameter family of couplings rather than having a dynamical chiral superfield. So you have the theory depends on a complex parameter that can be specified as a kind of coupling. To begin with, a separate one for each of the three manifolds. But anyway, we have a unique vacuum for each value of the coupling. When you analyze this using holomorphy, you can argue that you'd run into a contradiction if you assume that there are three different branches as there appear to be classically. You can argue instead that the picture is as I've drawn it here, that there's a one complex parameter family of theories. It has three ends, at each of which you have one of our manifolds, x1, x2, or x3. There also are three singular points where some of the physics blows up. And you can make smooth transitions from one to another by going around the singular points. Now, this isn't argued by comparing to type 2a. You can learn something by comparing to type 2a, and not enough, but not enough. So you can learn something by comparing to type 2a, because yes, indeed, S3 times S3 divided by U1 is S5 again, if you pick the correct U1. So you land in R6 again, but this time the brains are curved. So you can look in volume 2 of Joe's book, but he won't tell you how to calculate the spectrum of this brain. It is true that that if you look in Joyce's paper, you'll learn that there are three ways to deform this particular curved brain to a smooth special Lagrangian submanifold. And those three smooth choices that you can read about in his paper are what you get starting with the three X's. So we can map our question in M-theory to a question in type 2A that we can't answer very explicitly. But amusingly, from the fact that D-brain charge is measured by K-theory, we can deduce that yes, you can make transitions between these different manifolds. You see, the three smooth brains that Joyce gives you, to which this can be deformed, have the same K-theory class. So if D-brain charge is classified by K-theory, the answer to our question is yes, you can make transitions between them. But that does not show you whether you can make the transition smoothly or you have to go through a phase transition. And we weren't able to answer that by comparing to type 2A. To show that we didn't need, that there's no phase transition in going from one to another, and to describe the moduli space precisely, we applied considerations of holomorphy to some chiral observables that can be defined in this situation. So the details are much too complicated, so I won't go into them. But at infinity, in S3 times S3, there are three different three spheres that you worry about. They're related to the fact that we make those out of A, B, and C. And then you can define some chiral observables that vary as holomorphic functions of the coupling in terms of their volumes and the periods of the C field. So this gives some holomorphic functions on the moduli space, and they obey this relation here. So the moduli space isn't an abstract Riemann surface, but has a natural map to C star times C star. And then we analyzed the zeros and poles, and we showed we'd get a contradiction if we assumed there were three different branches. And assuming there was only one branch, we found the answer, we think, at least. That the holomorphic observables are given by that function where T is the coupling constant. T is the complex coupling constant. So one can make quantitative the conjecture of a T of alpha and Modestena, but you can smoothly interpolate between those things. I'm probably in the negative region, aren't I?
Too much negative region.
Okay. Well, now, to get back to the promise to at least vaguely make some hint about the fact that there is here a new insight about confinement, Acharya and the other authors replaced S3 times S3 by S3 times S3 divided by an ADE subgroup of SU2 and tried to investigate this situation, which is much richer and which we don't understand well enough for me to really present it today, even if I had more time. There are still three X's, and two of them are smooth and therefore manifestly describe physics with a mascot. But one of the X's has an ADE singularity that leads at low energies to gauge symmetry in R4. So if you can justify, now this is N equals 1 supersymmetric gauge theory, it's not the pure bosonic gauge theory. But still, if you can justify the claim that X1 is in the same universality class of the others, that will establish that the pure gauge theory is in the universality class of a theory with a mascot, and therefore that itself has a mascot. And I actually think that with this holomorphy type argument, it will be possible soon to make a pretty good argument for that. Now, Acharya gave an elegant explanation of confinement in this situation. So what do we mean by here explaining confinement? On this side, according to the conjecture of confinement, there will be confining QCD flux tubes associated with the center of the ADRE group. If this theory is in the same universality class as these must also have the confining strings.
But here, this is completely smooth. There's no strong coupling dynamics or anything. So you should be able to find the confining strings directly. So Acharya found them in a way that's reminiscent of MQCD, except that he was able to do the AD and E groups uniformly. So X2 and X3 are smooth manifolds that have an R4 factor that's not important. The important factor is S3 mod gamma, where gamma was the finite group that one divided by. And he gets strings coming from M2 brains with one leg wrapped on a one cycle and S3 mod gamma. And now here it's very important that these are classified not by homotopy but by homology, because if his one cycle, Pi1 would classify one cycles up to disks. H1 classifies them up to something. And even if the decay process has higher genus, that doesn't really matter here. So H1 is much littler than Pi1 and is the right thing for M theory and gives the right answer. So the strings that he gets from M2 brains are supposed to be classified by the center of G, whereas they are classified by this. But in fact, for all the ADE groups, the center of the group is equal to that H lower 1. So that's Acharya's point of view about confinement. To justify it better, we want to have stronger arguments that the three manifolds are in the same universality class, that you can make smooth transitions between them without a phase transition. And there's an analogous explanation of magnetic screening in this business. Well, this story, maybe if David's birthday was another month from now, there might have been a better way to finish this talk, at least if one had more time. But it wouldn't be a real explanation of confinement, which maybe will appear in time for the 61st birthday.
Questions for Ed? Tom?
These modes that here are just coupling modes.
Yes.
If you embed this into a compact manifold, presumably it's going to be modular, but I guess it's coupled from Langstroth directly.
Well, if you embed them in a compact manifold, they're going to be they'll be dynamical, definitely. And there's an interesting thing, which is that there's a superpotential as a function of those modes, which is, its physical interpretation is a little bit mysterious when they're moduli, but as soon as they become dynamical, it's important. And it's got poles at those three points I had marked before. Yes? I don't know. I think it's analogous to things you figured out in the past. So maybe you could help.
Other questions? Well, I think we've come to the end, and we're going to have to close the conference in a couple of minutes. But several things that I would like to say. First of all, I think we should thank the organizers, Joe and Frank. I think that all of us would also like to thank the staff of the ITP because they put on a tremendous job. And then I think finally, there is a person we have to thank, and I think that is David, because not we wouldn't be here. Well, actually, maybe not true. But I think all of us have been inspired by David over many years. I've known David for roughly 20 years now. And he's a very special person. And I think those of us who have interacted with David all agree that he's played a very special role in our lives. So, thanks.
Good things happen. Very marvelous things. is quite overwhelming. Thank you all.